We are at quorum, and so the committee will come to order. My apologies to the public. We were a bit delayed on the House floor in session, and so we're not starting at the time that we're committed to starting, but we're going to have a good quality hearing today. Today, we're going to be covering issues related to youth and criminal justice. There'll be some presentations and then a few bills as well. Looking forward to this conversation. In the meantime, we do have a quick order of business, and I believe Representative Christensen, you've got a motion in regards to the February 18th minutes.
Yes, on page 2 of the minutes, if we could add an 8 to Chair Mariani's HF321.
Very well. So Representative Christensen moves adoption of the February 18th minutes with that verbal amendment. Discussion. All in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, same sign. Motion prevails. Thank you, Representative Christensen, and thank you, members. We're going to begin today's conversation and deliberations with a presentation by the Minnesota Youth Council. And so I'd ask the presenters to come forward to the witness table. And we had the privilege of hearing from representatives from the Youth Council last year. We're hoping that we have a steady relationship with the Youth Council here. So welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the record and give us your thoughts and testimony.
Yeah, my name is Hala Henderson. I'm the policy coordinator with the Minnesota Alliance with Youth, and I work alongside the Youth Council. So I'm here on behalf of one of our youth representatives, Paula Acapo. She currently is in school and wasn't able to make the trip over here. But we feel that it's really important that young people are included in conversations in every space that it's about them. So knowing particularly Paula's commitment to criminal justice reform and addressing the impact on juveniles in the juvenile justice system, we were really happy to be here and to stand behind her. So here are Paula's words. My name is Paula Acapo, and I am currently a sophomore at Math and Science Academy and a representative on the Minnesota Youth Council. I'm writing here today in support of risk assessments and youth intervention programs, in part due to the research that has found both measures, risk assessments and youth intervention programs, reduce juvenile detention rates. I also believe that we have a moral obligation to find alternatives to jailing children. My first introduction to the juvenile justice system was when I was 14 years old and searching for an essay topic for school. I knew of the criminal and juvenile justice system before, but this was my first experience doing research on the system. After reading so many horror stories about the system, I came to realize that most of these adult offenders were introduced to it when they were young. I could not believe that kids my age were being subjected to this kind of treatment. It also angered me that most of the victims were children of color. I started to realize that this was not the first time I was dealing with these issues and that they don't start when someone is put in jail. When I was younger, I remembered how often my cousin was sent to the principal's office. My cousin was like any other rowdy second grader. He was noisy, loud, and always wanted to play around. However, for some reason, his actions, like accidentally falling asleep in class, would automatically result in him being sent to the principal's office. No other kids in his school or in his class were sent to the principal's office as much as him. It came to the point where my aunt and my mother started to get worried. Luckily, things de-escalated, and my cousin, just like any other rowdy kid, became less rowdy. However, this is not the case for many kids in the state. While my cousin was never introduced into the juvenile justice system, there are so many kids his age that were introduced into it. This not only affects the young people that are subjected to this, but also the communities they come from. Looking back at it, my mother and aunt were worried because they thought my cousin was going to be targeted. They knew the statistics about black boys being sent to prison and youth detention centers for behaviors like his, behavior that was totally acceptable from any other boy that didn't look like him. The reason I am passionate about criminal justice reform, particularly with juveniles, is that these issues are not just because I am a person of color or even because my cousin experienced what he did. I am passionate about this because I believe it is morally wrong to allow children who should be receiving a quality education and enjoying their lives to be subjected to violence in juvenile detention centers. And I believe when risk assessments and intervention programs are used effectively, they are beneficial to both the communities they serve and the children they help. Thank you for your commitment to hearing Paula's story, and we hope that you continue to call on young people to share both their experiences within the criminal justice system and those who see the impact it has on young people across the state.
Thank you, Ms. Henderson. Just a few quick thoughts. One is that we've established and we hope to continue carrying out a strong practice here of hearing directly from those who are directly impacted by the decisions that we deliberate and that we act on here. So it's vitally important for us to have youth voices a number of times here in our deliberations. I'm trying to remember what my second point is. I guess my really important point was that point. Please convey our wishes of getting better to the person who offered the testimony via you with the written comments. Are there any questions or comments for Ms. Henderson? Representative Considine and Representative Pinto.
Thank you, Chair Mariani. And I would just like to remind the committee that under former Chair Cornish, that we heard from Right on Corrections, a very conservative group out of Texas, that money spent on youth intervention was where we got the most bang for our buck, and that the earlier the intervention, the better the results. And they were strongly in favor of youth intervention programs. Thank you.
Thank you for that reminder, Representative Pinto.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I just want to make sure that folks, I just want to make sure to lift up the work of the Youth Council more broadly. And I've had the chance to work with Ms. Henderson on a number of occasions, and they do really incredible work providing the input of youth to us, and it's really helpful. And so many thanks to her and to the young people she works with. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Very well, Representative Evans.
Thank you, Chair. Ms. Henderson, I just wanted to thank the Minnesota Youth Council for your support of House File 3453.
Very well. Thank you again, Ms. Henderson. With that, we're going to take up House File 3105, Representative Ellison. Members, this bill references probationary sentences for nonviolent offenders. Representative Edelson moves House File 3105 to be referred to the General Register. And Representative Edelson, you have an amendment. I leave it to you whether you want to move that now or decide the bill first.
Thank you, Chair. Yes, I move the A1 amendment.
Very well. Representative Edelson moves the A1 amendment. We'll put the proposal in the form that she wishes us to debate it today. All in favor of that motion, please say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, same sign. Motion prevails. House File 3105, as amended, is before us. Representative Anderson.
Thank you, Chair. House File 3105 is what we're calling the primary caregiver bill. It encourages alternatives to incarceration for primary caregivers. Currently, judges and courts are able to consider social and economic factors in granting dispositional departures. However, this bill provides clarity that's taking one's relationship with their child into consideration. Chair, I would like to just move to my testifiers in terms of efficiency of time.
Very well.
Thank you very much. My name is Tanya Huntsey. I'm an incarceration survivor. I'm also the founder of We Rise Leadership Collective. We're a collective of formerly incarcerated women doing systems and policy change with a restorative, transformative, and healing justice lens. I know that many of you on this committee have heard my story, but I want to tell it again, and it's not just my story. It's so many other people who have been touched by the criminal justice system in Minnesota. it's not just our story, it's also our children's story and the continued intergenerational trauma that happens due to incarceration. My incarceration started at the age of 12. I came from an abusive home with a lot of chemical dependency issues, and from that didn't have a stable and a loving home to be in. And so I went to the streets to survive. And you know, the only way that a young girl survives in the streets is either by selling drugs or selling their body. And I like to say that I was privileged enough to be able to have a connection to sell drugs, because I don't think that I would be able to find healing from the other way. At the age of 16, I became pregnant, and I remember thinking that I wanted nothing more than to be able to give that child the love that I didn't have, to give them the stability and the home and the family that I never had. And I remember making a vow that I would never let my demons affect this child, and I failed miserably because I continued to use drugs because I didn't know how to deal with my trauma. And from that, I continued to be incarcerated. And I was incarcerated in and out of incarceration 25 years of my life. I have a 25-year-old, I have a 19-year-old, and I have a 5-year-old. And my 19-year-old and 25-year-old still deal with the trauma of me being incarcerated throughout their lives. They still come at me and say, you know, but you were incarcerated. You weren't there for me, Mom. And I can't take that away from them. Even my 5-year-old, who's never been away from me, barely to go to the bathroom, as most moms in here understand that. Some dads, too, I'm sure. But I still deal with the fact of trying to bond with him and to hold a bond with him, because I have this fear, this underlying fear that something's going to happen and I'm going to be incarcerated again and I'm going to lose my child. I'm going to lose that bond with them. While incarcerated, at one time I spent a year without being able to see my two children, because at that county jail did not have allow minors to visit if you were not sentenced, and I wasn't sentenced during that time. My 2-year-old at the time, I would sometimes get money to be able to call him, maybe once or twice, you know, maybe once a month, and I would spend that time singing "You Are My Sunshine" to him. When I was finally released from that county jail a year later, and I walked up to him, and he looked at me and didn't realize who I was until I started singing "You Are My Sunshine." And then he ran up to me and said, "Mama," and jumped in my arms. The continued trauma of being incarcerated and coming into the community and trying to build a life after you've been separated for so long, it doesn't end. Incarceration doesn't end the day that we walk out those doors. It's just beginning in some senses, because we're trying to build a life and trying to have a foundation. If we could just keep people in the community, give them the supports in the community, because most of the time when we're looking at women especially, and in Minnesota last year, 37,000 women were released from incarceration. 37,000, that's jails and prisons. And you know, it doesn't state how long those stays were, but that's the number, and that's from the Prison Policy Initiative. But if we look at that, that's how many families that are affected. How many times are they trying to rebuild a life? Over and over and over again. If we could keep them in the community, because most of those times it's about drug addiction, it's alcohol addiction, it's surviving poverty. And if we could do that and let the community take up and start to build around a support network where we don't have to continue to re-enter, we don't have to continue that trauma. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Halsey, for your powerful testimony. And also, I want to acknowledge your leadership on our participation in our Sentencing Guidelines Commission. You bring the same level of humanity and wisdom to that body that you're bringing to this body as well. So thank you for your service. Commissioner Schnell, welcome.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair, committee members. It's a pleasure to be here to speak to this issue. It's really important to put this in context, and that context really is that in accordance with the current sentencing guidelines, the courts are able to place a defendant on probation when the risk to the public is outweighed by the evidence that they're motivated to rehabilitation. That is the reality. And so these provisions exist currently in sentencing policy. The ability to now look at and address the primary caretaker issues I think reflects really smart policy. It reflects the ability of the courts to apply the kind of the right resources, the right fit, at the right time for the right reason. As Tanya was talking, I couldn't help but think about the time I've had to spend with some of the mothers groups at Shakopee. And oftentimes we're talking about people who are incarcerated for very short periods of time, matters of months, in some cases less. I don't think it's possible, as I think about my own children and being separated like that, I think about the impacts on that family. And frankly, I think about the numerous consequences that oftentimes come to children who themselves were not involved in any type of wrongdoing, yet they bear oftentimes the impact of the incarcerated parent. And I think we have to recognize the fact that the consequences for these families, the impact on these children due to the separation, ultimately is contrary to the fundamental interest that we have in creating community safety. And so as the department representative of the Department of Corrections, I stand in full support of this. I think this is and does reflect smart policy that is in the long-term best interest of community safety. And I thank you for the opportunity to offer my view.
Thank you, Commissioner.
Chair, Professor Rebecca Schlafer is, like many people I hear, has the flu today. So we do have a substitute for her. Dr. Laurel Davis will be testifying from the University of Minnesota. She's a researcher.
Very well. Welcome to the committee, Dr. Davis.
Thank you. Thanks for having me in replacement for my better substitute. I'm a researcher in the Department of Pediatrics. My research focuses on vulnerable children and families. Several years ago, me and Dr. Schlafer set out to learn as much as we could about children in Minnesota who had been affected by parental incarceration. We used the Minnesota Student Survey, which is a statewide survey of youth, and we found that 1 in 6 youth in Minnesota reported a history of parental incarceration, which is a truly stunning statistic. And what's even more stunning is that as we started to dig into the responses on other parts of the survey, we found that these young people who'd had an incarcerated parent fared worse than their peers on every single measure of health and development. They are more likely to be anxious and depressed and to try to commit suicide. They are more likely to skip school. They're more likely to use alcohol, tobacco, marijuana, and other drugs, and they're more likely to be engaged in violence. So simply put, in every way that you can look at these young people, they are doing significantly worse than their peers. It's important for you to know that about 2/3 of men in Minnesota prisons are fathers of minor children, and more than half of them lived with their kids before they were arrested. And for women, those rates are even higher. 3/4 are mothers of minor children, and the majority of them were living with their kids prior to arrest. Research has conclusively shown that consistent caregiving is a fundamental ingredient of child development. We know without a doubt that separating children from their parents is traumatic and it can have devastating consequences for their health and development across the life course. But our policies call for doing that in many cases where other options actually could be more efficient and also avoid making children the collateral consequences of their parents' mistakes. Furthermore, incarceration rarely addresses the challenges that parents are facing that cause them to become incarcerated in the first place. So, for example, if you consider a single mom and a DWI offender who is sentenced to 3 months, her children's lives are turned upside down. And meanwhile, the mother isn't going to be incarcerated long enough to receive effective substance use treatment. And she's been punished for her crime, but so have her children. And neither she and her children are better off than before she was incarcerated. The legislation before you aims to provide decision makers with the information they need to best support children and families in the state of Minnesota. The courts will be better informed as they determine whether all of these youth in Minnesota need to be separated from their parents or not. And it's likely that in many cases, alternatives to incarceration could accomplish the very important goal of holding parents accountable for their crimes without unnecessarily harming their children. And for that reason, I urge you to support this House file. Thank you.
Thank you, Dr. Davis. And I'm sorry, Dr. Davis.
Yes.
Just a thing we have to do. Can you, just for the record, state your name?
Certainly.
For the record.
Laurel Davis.
Very well. Thank you.
Chair Mariani and committee members, my name is William Ward. I'm the State Public Defender for Minnesota. I echo a lot of the same remarks that have been provided to this committee already, and I suspect that many of you think I'm going to be talking about the clients in particular, but I also want to focus on the children. Obviously, as has been stated, the importance of family unification is of utmost importance for the long-term success of our children. And basically, as has been stated already, that the taking away the children and the effects of the mistakes of others, the long-term consequences often, too oftentimes, makes them my clients. And that's why I'm in support of this bill. And I want to talk really briefly about really what this bill is doing. And as Commissioner Schnell stated earlier, there are tools available to the courts now through the Sentencing Guidelines Commission and by statute. And I am in support of the bill as amended to make sure that we address that those statutory provisions and the guidelines exist at this current time. But just like on bail situations, that does not mean the court is following the guideline recommendations. Just like on the rules of the Supreme Court, that does not mean the courts are following what the rules are in operating in their courtrooms every single day. This bill is not particularly onerous. It's first asking the court to make a determination if the person is a primary caregiver, and second is if and so that parent or that individual is, the court may use that as a consideration regarding particular amenability to probation. It's not onerous, but it's an incredibly important policy for this committee to consider. It's not a get-out-of-prison-free card, which I'm going to hear over and over. This is make it easy for people. That's simply not true. If you look at the onerous conditions that the court can apply if indeed sentencing this individual to probation, I'll bet you most of you in this room do not abide by those conditions. So let's please not think about this as an easy way out and not putting people in the prison. It's about giving individuals the tools for success. I also ask you to consider this bill like you consider other bills when you think about victims in this state, because the victims in these cases truly are the children. The actions taken by parents, as the professor said, it's the kids who suffer. They are traumatized when separated from their kids, and all of you know that that trauma leads to oftentimes long-term consequences for the child. None of you know this, but as part of my volunteer work, I'm a board member of a nonprofit called My Very Own Bed. It's a very simple concept developed by an executive director named Michael Allen. And what we do is supply beds to kids in need in this community. And you think that's not a big deal. It is a big deal. I had no idea how many of our children do not have a bed to sleep on. So this nonprofit supplies beds, box springs, mattresses, sheets, and pillows, and embroidered blankets, so a child has a place to sleep at night. And the reason we do this is because the data is clear that with a good night's sleep, children will succeed. And success is what we all want for all of our communities. We talked about youth intervention earlier. That is youth intervention. It's helping provide some measure of success for kids to have a place to sleep, and it's helping out parents who do not have the means to do so. I tell you that because this bill will do the same thing. You know, I saw the overlap in my job, and the overlap is this. If I have an ability in my professional career now of 32 years in the criminal court system to help people, the best way I can help people is to keep them from coming into the system in the first place. That's what this bill will do. We tend to forget about the consequences when we think we're doing good and making good decisions. But for so many clients of mine who suffer from mental illness, addictions, and they're not making decisions, but they're reacting without thinking. It's the children who are suffering those consequences, and this bill allows for an opportunity for children to succeed long-term, which is important for all of us.
Thank you, Mr. Ward. Members, Commissioner Schnell and Ms. Hansi, I'm sorry. I thought you were a company rep. I just wanted to let you know the commissioner stepped down, and the reason he did is because he's meeting with survivors in a few minutes. And so I just wanted, if you had any questions for the commissioner, we can always have him come back at a future time and answer those questions. At this point, Representative Adelson, I think we're open for questions and comments from the committee. And at some point, members, I'll stop us and see if anyone else in the public wishes to comment. With that, Representative Representative Johnson.
Mr. Chair, Representative Edelson, one thing that we've been working on over the year, the entire time I've been down here, is sentencing disparity. I have a concern on this bill that it's going to increase sentence disparity. Because what you're looking at on this bill is if a person that commits a crime as a child, they're going to do downward departures, and a lot of them. Just the probation, no prison time at all. But if you're in the unfortunate instance of committing a crime and don't have a child, you're going to go to prison, by the way this bill is written. We've worked very hard over the years to have consistent. That's why we started Sentencing Guidelines Commission, so we can have standard sentences throughout the state. This bill is going to blow that up. So how are you going to resolve that issue to stop the disparity in sentences between two people just because one has a child and one doesn't?
Mr. Chair.
Mr. Ward.
Commissioner Johnson, I respectfully disagree with that, and here's why. Right now, many courts believe that this is considered a socioeconomic issue that cannot be used in a mitigating way. And what this bill does is allow for this to be an additional mitigation that could be taken into consideration as to whether or not a person is particularly amenable. The bill does not say shall sentence someone to probation, but it provides for another factor to be looked at as a mitigating factor to determine whether or not they will depart. That will not be a disparaging thing from a person with children or not having children. It's another factor that can be looked at in addition to the other factors that are addressed in statute and also by the Sentencing Guidelines Commission.
Senator Edelson.
Chair, Dr. Davis also had a comment on this.
Dr. Davis, please.
I'd like to contest the idea that all disparities are bad in this instance. We have sentencing guidelines for a reason, as you indicated, and we also have latitude within sentencing guidelines for many very good reasons. The current sentencing guidelines stipulate a number of disparate factors that can be used as judges try to make these decisions. And those exact factors exist for a reason. They exist because we have determined as a community that they matter and that they could be instrumental in terms of what kinds of outcomes we expect in different scenarios. And so I would like to put forth the idea that disparity in sentencing is not necessarily a bad thing. The place where we'd like to think about eliminating disparities are along personal characteristics that people can't change, things like their race. Sentencing disparities along racial lines are a very bad thing. But not all disparities are wrong in this instance.
Representative Johnson.
Chair Mariani, members, testifiers, any disparity is wrong. In the criminal justice system, justice is blind. It treats everybody the same. That's why the lady has the...
It doesn't.
A chair. I would strongly disagree with that justice is blind.
Representative Pinto.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I guess, yes, I just want to acknowledge, right, that I mean, disparity, this means, it just means difference. It means that that you're making a difference based on certain factors. And if you look at the sentencing guidelines, as was referenced by the testifiers, there are a number of elements to that. I guess I just want to make a note that the structure of the bill is really focused on the defendant's amenability to probation, and that is a test that is in the law right now, and what the bill and what the law recognizes is that if someone's going to be particularly amenable to being on probation, then there's a particular reason to put them on probation rather than spending the time and money and having them be in prison. And that's something that's in the law right now. What the proposal recognizes, it seems to me, is the fact that there are defendants who are going to be particularly amenable because of a factor that may well be overlooked by courts, which is their connection with their families. Now, I will say that as as an advocate for children, it seems to me that there's also a significant impact on children, on families, as a part of this, which I'm so glad that we're recognizing. But to your point, Representative Johnson, it seems to me that this is squarely in the current set of disparities, and that if someone shows they're particularly amenable to probation right now under the law, they're more likely to get probation. Seems like a good thing. And that's how the law works currently, and this would simply enhance that along the way. So I want to thank Representative Edelson and the testifiers. And I guess finally, Mr. Chair, to just point the committee, because this particular committee is not part of it, the Corrections and Early Childhood Committees had a joint hearing about 2 weeks ago with Chair Considine to hear about the impact of incarceration on kids and families, and talked a lot about some of the points we've made so far, featuring Dr. Schlafer, among others. And if folks have not seen that, I thought it was some really powerful testimony. I really urge everyone to check it out. So thank you, Representative Edelson, to your testifiers.
It struck me that the proposed legislation is constructed on existing structure and approaches in our law. In other words, there are mitigating factors that are part of sentencing decisions. Not only has that been affirmed through the guidelines of the Sentencing Guidelines Commission, but it also exists in the form of precedents and court decisions as well. With that, members, I'm going to open it up to see if anyone from the public wishes to comment for or against the bill. Yes, please come forward. Welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the record and give us your thoughts.
My name is Linda Garrett Johnson, and I actually wasn't planning on speaking today. I was planning on just listening. As I have said to you, Chair Mariani, I had served about 25 years ago on the Extended Jurisdiction Juvenile Advisory Committee for the state of Minnesota when they created one, and I was also on the Umbrella Rule Advisory Committee, in which the Department of Human Services and the Department of Corrections worked together, and they were both looking at these types of issues. One of the reasons why I wanted to speak today was when the issue of disparities came up and the fact that justice is supposed to be blind. And the one thing that I just wanted to say, it's probably one of the only things that I will say about this, is that those of us in this room who are of color know that justice is not necessarily blind. And the way that one of the biggest ways that disparities can play out in the criminal justice and juvenile justice systems both are whether or not you have access to an attorney that can pay to state your case. Nothing wrong with public defenders at all. They do a great job. However, it's one thing to have an attorney that you can spend a lot of money on, and it's another thing to have a public defender that has a huge caseload and has lots of people to see. So I just wanted to point that out, is that that's one of the ways in which the juvenile justice system has some disparities forever. So when we're thinking about something like this and thinking about a departure from the sentencing guidelines, I think that what we want to consider is that for a young person that does not have access to a lawyer that can really speak their case and really plead it and bring all kinds of research to the judge, they may or may not be able to access some of the things that we'd like them to. So I hope that this committee will consider this very needed, I feel, piece of legislation.
Thank you, Ms. Garrett Johnson. And just in full disclosure, Ms. Garrett Johnson is also part of a very broad extended family, in my family. And so we've known each other for quite a while, and I know your work in the public sphere, and I want to thank you for that on behalf of justice and racial justice and criminal justice reform. Thank you. Any further testimony? Please come forward. Welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the record share your thoughts with us.
My name is Sheila Delaney, and I wasn't planning to speak today either, but I felt compelled to speak. Because as this conversation continues, I think many of us are in agreement with the premises included in this bill, but I can foresee the issue of disparities being raised as a as an issue that perhaps could stop this bill as it progresses throughout this legislative season. I appreciate your raising that issue. But what I'd like to state is that how could it be possible for a judge taking a look in a holistic way of all the factors in someone's life would then negatively penalize the next person in front of the judge? I know that's not how it works, but there's not a quota system. There's nothing to preclude, if I was a mother, that judge would be considering the whole picture of my life. And speaking to Representative Pinto's point, simply being able to factor in the fact that I was a parent does not prohibit any further justice for the next person in front of that judge. So I don't see that disparities argument is holding weight, and I would hate for that to be carried forward. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Delaney. Any further testimony? If not, then Representative Matheson.
Thank you, Chair. This bill is to look at all of us and look at compassion for children. That's really what this is about. I did some policy work with incarcerated women at Shakopee this summer, and the reason I reached out to, you know, Tanya and I start working together is because I noticed a lot of the women that were there were short stays, that they had to find places for their kids to go. And they, one woman, you used, Professor, you used the example of a DWI. One woman had her second DWI, was incarcerated, and she had not received a Rule 25. She had not received any treatment. And it just made me think, are we doing this right? And I think that's a question we can ask. Tennessee and Massachusetts actually have passed this legislation. We do have a Republican in the Senate as of this week. And so I think that this can be bipartisan. So thank you, Chair.
Thank you, Representative Edelson, for bringing us this important bill. Seems to me that our work here is about constantly driving humanity in all our actions, including our laws and criminal justice and public safety. And so in that spirit, I welcome your bill. I also want to acknowledge Chair Pinto's hearing on children, parents, mothers in particular, who are in our correction system, the impact through testimony that you and Chair Considine were able to unearth in that joint hearing. I really do hope that it will be our continued practice in this committee that we constantly hold people accountable, and we constantly do that in a humane and life-sustaining and community-building way. With that, members, Representative Edelson renews her motion that House File 3105, as amended, be re-referred to the General Register. All in favor of that motion, please say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, same sign.
No.
Motion prevails. Thank you, Representative Ellison. Representative Edelson, you get to park in that seat, I guess, for a little while, because the next bill is also yours, House File 3453. Representative Edelson moves that House File, Representative Edelson moves that House File 3453 be re-referred to the General Register, and Representative Edelson, it will be our intention.
Yes, I did.
Well, I'm not sure. We are going to. All right. Very well. you have another bill up that I think we're laying over, so I'm confusing the two, but. Representative Edelson, your motion is before us, House File 3453.
Thank you, Chair. House File 3453, this bill seeks to limit how restraints, or we can call them shackles at sometimes, are used with youth. This bill states that restraints may not be used on a child appearing in court unless there are specific, and it kind of enumerates them, but the use of restraints are necessary, and if they're not necessary, that we would not use them. Effective April 2021, this bill would help us help the state streamline how restraints are used. I received actually a call over the last few months on a youth that was being had restraints were used, and actually I called the Department of Corrections right here. I called Curtis to notify him that they were improperly being used, and so we do know that it's happening. I received the call myself. The second part of this bill is to implement the use of an objective juvenile risk assessment instrument. And Commissioner, Chair, I will move straight to my testifier. And I don't know which one are you going to testify. Okay, all right. I'll move straight to my testifiers.
Very well. Mr. Shanklin, I take it you're going first?
I'll go first.
Very well. Welcome to the committee, sir.
Chair Mariani, members of the committee, first and foremost, I want to say thank you for the opportunity to have to be able to talk to you all about our youth. But I also want to take this opportunity, because I know we were going to present earlier much broadly about the current state of juvenile justice, and my colleague Katrina Dexter can't be here today because she's sick, which seems to be the case for a couple folks. Mm-hmm. And I know it bothers her not to be here. Any of you who know Katrina knows about her passion and her commitment to these issues, and she would like nothing better than to be here and to be able to speak passionately about that. So I offer apology for her. I'm just going to speak more broadly, and then I'm going to turn it over to another one of my colleagues, Ms. Davis, who will talk more about the substantive of the bills. But I just wanted to remind everyone as to why we are here and who we are talking about. Because we're talking about youth. And if you all have heard myself and my colleague in our former space, which was as the JDAI co-coordinators for the state, you would hear us reference many a time what we refer to as the My Child Test. And when we say that, it's because for all of us, particularly those of you who has youth, what is it that you would want for your child if your child made an unfortunate choice or was with a group of youth who made an unfortunate choice? How would you want their experience to be when they got introduced to the criminal justice system? And I would assume that you would want it to be one that, A, would make sure they receive the services that they need, but also would be one to put them in a position to ensure that they don't return. And that's if we're just talking about globally. But we can also talk about statute here to what Minnesota has committed to when we talk about our youth. If we're talking about Minnesota statute, I believe it's 260B subdivision 2, which talks about the juvenile court proceedings. And in that statute, it lays out clearly that unlike in the adult court, the juvenile court is not a criminal proceeding, but rather a civil proceeding, which is used not to design punishment or to issue blame, but to look at ways in which we can look at rehabilitation for our youth. Look at ways in which we can meet their needs. And I'm paraphrasing, so don't hold me to the exact words. But in the spirit, that's the statute that we have here in Minnesota. I think this is even more important, and Representative Johnson brought this up when we talk about disparities. There are significant disparities within the system, and they're not good, particularly for youth of color and our American Indian Native American youth. On any given year, about 22,000 youth are arrested here in Minnesota. Almost 70 to 75% of those youth are youth of color, are American Indian youth. That's an issue within itself, but even more so an issue is what those youth are actually being arrested for. A vast majority of those youth, close to 70%, are arrested for what we consider our Part II offenses, which is our lesser persons or property crimes. So not only do we have the disparities, we also have to think about, too, exactly what these youth are being arrested for that leads to those disparities. And it's not just at arrest. You can look at probation. Currently, there's about 6,000 youth right now on probation. Almost half of those youth are youth of color, are American Indian youth. So at each decision point that you look at within the system, you will see desperate treatment there. I would like to think, again, thinking about your own youth and what you would want their experience to be, that we can do better. We can do better than the last 3 to 4 decades of the ways in which we implemented strategies and policies to respond to the public chatter about super predators, and we think about the outcomes that that has lent us over this time, I would care to say that those haven't been good, nor have they been in the best interest of our young men and women who are struggling with the issues and trauma that manifests in itself a lot differently than it does for adults. I'm confident that we can do better, and my goal and my mission is to make sure that we are doing better. The two pieces of legislation I'm thankful that Representative Adelson has brought forth speak to that. One of them is the valid risk assessment instrument that my colleague Ms. Sarah Davis will speak to. And the other one, as Ms. Adelson spoke about, also deals with how do we treat youth when they come before a court? Because we talk about bias and those type of things. And think about it, what that means for a youth who comes in and shackles and cuffs. Oh, I'm not stealing some of the stuff. You're going to say that, Mike. As opposed to coming in their own regular clothes, being accompanied by an adult rather than being accompanied by a sheriff or bailiff into that court proceeding. With that, I'll yield my time to my colleague and be open for any questions that follow. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Shanklin. And I am going to ask you to, just for the record, just to state your name on the record.
Curtis Shanklin, Deputy Commissioner, Department of Corrections.
Very well. Very quickly, sir, just if you can remind me again, so it was 70% of the 75% of students of students of color and indigenous students in corrections, they're there for part two offenses?
Well, we consider are arrested for our, what we consider our part two offenses.
Can you tell me, remind me again what those are?
Those are our lesser persons or property crimes. So these are not our part one offenses. And I think there's a number of lawyers who are sitting around the table who can also speak to this. But those are not our significant violent level persons or property crimes. So now we're not talking about first degree murder, first degree assault, burglary of an occupied dwelling. We're talking about disorderly conducts, fifth degree assaults, youth getting into it at school. And then we're even talking about statuses, and we're talking things like loitering, curfew. And although we've been successful, I also don't want to leave out the fact that, well, I mean, we have been successful across the state with reducing our numbers. I mean, there's been a trend that actually juvenile arrest has gone down since 2000, and I think it's around 2000 up until this point by over 70%. My work in my previous capacity leading JDAI for the state, we were able to decrease our detention numbers by close to 80% around the state. And we did all of this without compromising public safety. So this work can be done. And this wasn't just a metro-centric work. I mean, we've done work as far as what I consider up in True North, up in the 9th Judicial District, to St. Louis County, to here in the metro, and on down to Rice County. So there has been great work that can be built upon when it comes to reducing the number of youth that we currently have in our secure detention facilities, which if you haven't had opportunity to visit them, they're not a summer camp. They are more the equivalents of our adult prisons and jails. So there has been success around this state in making sure that we're looking at what is appropriate for our youth when we're thinking about how we place our youth in secure confinement, but we can do a lot better, primarily when we see more often our youth now who are introduced or who are winding up in secure detention are there for technical violations more so than they are now for new offenses. And that's something that seems to be prevalent around the state. And I think it's also incumbent upon us to think about in our more rural areas, what are we doing to make sure they have the resources they need to actually address some of these issues of chemical dependency and mental health? Because when you get out into greater Minnesota, as many of y'all are aware, where the resources are limited, they're trying to do the best they can to make sure they're providing good services for those youth. But this needs to be a shared effort and a shared responsibility on how we're going to meet the needs of our youth. And I think it's incumbent upon all of us to take that and run with it.
Mr. Shanklin, we certainly will look for an opportunity to have your colleague, your former colleague Judy AI, your colleague in the work, join us at some point to go over the data that in many ways you've already did, a good chunk of it. And so members, I do want to reference in your packet the PowerPoint, which has critical components of data that Mr. Shanklin just shared, and so I would encourage you to look at that. And if there's a strong interest, we can certainly have spend some more time in a future hearing going through. I think it's particularly important data for us to center ourselves as we make decisions. And by the way, Mr. Shanklin, I want to thank you for your past leadership of JDAI and bringing that vision to this state and being that strong presence in working with our state and with local corrections to have, in my opinion, a much more human-centered approach that really is focused on this issue of rehabilitation and redemption and helping young people to achieve good things.
Absolutely.
So with that, I'm going to shift over to Ms. Davis. Welcome to the committee. It's very good to see you again.
Thank you, Chair Mariani. And just to introduce myself, my name is Sarah Davis, the Associate Director at the Legal Rights Center, which is in Minneapolis. I'm a lawyer, and so I'm here today to talk about the substance of the provisions that are before you in House File 3453. This bill focuses on two important changes to our juvenile justice system, and really what these changes are about is ending a practice of what I would call justice by geography. So we've had some important dialogue in here already today about disparities and about, you know, disparate treatment for folks. And these provisions are really fundamentally about ending those justice by geography disparities that we're seeing in Minnesota on two very specific things. So the first section would end the practice of indiscriminately shackling children in juvenile courts. So this happens in some parts of Minnesota, and it doesn't happen in other counties in Minnesota. It really depends for the child which side of the county line you were on when you were picked up. And the problem with this fundamentally, beyond the fundamental fairness challenge of this justice by geography issue, is that it's deeply humiliating and deeply traumatizing for children to come into court in ankle and wrist shackles. And there's been a lot of research on this, that it's stigmatizing, traumatizing, and it really does have a future impact on kids. And the other side of this is that it's really unnecessary. This provision would not say that a judge would not end a judge's authority to be able to order the use of restraints when it's necessary. All it does is say that the presumption is that it's not necessary, and if somebody feels that it is, that the judge could order that they be used in that case if the child poses an actual flight or safety risk. So what we're just saying is let's just shift it so that all kids in Minnesota have the same presumption, which many, you know, here in Hennepin County where I practice law, children are not shackled when they're brought in the courtroom. But in other counties they are. And, you know, that justice by geography should not stand. I'll just point out, as of September of 2019, 32 states across this nation have ended this practice of indiscriminate shackling. Among those, Nebraska, Nevada, North Carolina, South Carolina, Utah, 32 states have done this, and Minnesota just really needs to join the majority of states in moving this forward. I'll also say that this is really not it's not a partisan issue, and it's not, you know, it's not just me here from the Legal Rights Center saying that. So on a national level, this is supported by the American Bar Association, the Association of Prosecuting Attorneys, National Association of Counties, National Council of Juvenile and Family Court Judges. I could go on. There's a huge list of national organizations supporting this. And locally here in Minnesota, we've had the conversations with the county attorneys, with the sheriffs. This is not... There's really no meaningful opposition, or to my knowledge, any opposition to this change. It's just something that has not been able to move forward yet through the legislature. And so, you know, really just would ask Minnesota to take the step forward and join the vast majority of states in protecting kids and ending this practice of justice by geography. The other provision, Section 2, is about the use of an objective risk assessment instrument. And again, this is a justice by geography issue here in Minnesota. So there are counties in Minnesota where that already use an objective risk assessment instrument, and my colleague, Deputy Commissioner Shanklin from the Department of Corrections, talked about the work that he did in his former role with JDAI to work on that. And it's been really, really successful. In some ways, it's been billed as, you know, one of the most successful juvenile justice reforms that the state has undertaken without having any negative impact on public safety. And so what we're talking about here is ensuring that youth, regardless of what county they're in, when they're being considered for being placed in a secure facility, which we know can lead to long-term life consequences for children, and it has negative impacts, that decision is being made based on evidence-based criteria, and that we're using risk assessment instrument tools to help us make that decision. Again, these are really, somebody mentioned earlier a presentation in prior years by a group, I think it was called Right on Crime or something like that. These are really not partisan issues. These are very much about doing what's right for kids and protecting our future, protecting our youth. And so just asking this committee to move this forward so that we can end on these two issues, the practice of justice by geography here in Minnesota. Thank you. And I'm happy to take any questions.
Very well. We do have some questions from committee members. Representative Considine. Chair Considine.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. As I'm reading this bill, it's pretty much strictly related to courts. Why aren't other venues, I mean, doctor appointments, I mean, why is it limited just to courts?
Chair Mariana, are you regarding the shackling provision?
Shackling provision talks about being in court. I don't see any other thing in here other than court, and I would think that we would want to, again, I understand that sometimes there is a necessity for restraints, but if you have somebody that's in custody, not taking them to a medical appointment, for example, in shackles.
Deputy
Chair Mariani, Chair Constantine, thanks for the question. Part of it has to do with us also trying to be mindful and respectful to our law enforcement partners who do transport. I think you raise a valid point. I think this gives us a starting point at its core to say that when youth go into the courtroom, that they should be treated in the most equitable fashion. Our first bill did start off in transport, and after some conversations with our sheriff law enforcement partners, we decided to amend this provision where it only applies strictly within the courtroom. I do think you raise a good point because, as many of you know, particularly those who have worked in this space, there are youth who are often transported, as the chair mentioned, whether it's to doctor's appointment, mental health appointments that are outside of the facility where they are placed in restraints or shackles. So I think that's a good point. And hopefully something that we can revisit in the future. But for us, this was a starting point, and we also wanted to be mindful of some of those concerns raised by some of our law enforcement partners.
Chair Council.
Thank you so much. But again, if you're doing the risk assessment, there's not a necessity, then there is a necessity by all means. But if there's not, then I don't know why we would continue. Thank you.
Absolutely, Chair. Point noted. Thanks.
Representative Johnson.
Mr. Chair, Representative Edelson. On line, well, actually, I understand this bill, but I've done bailiffing and brought a number of juveniles to the court systems. In my career, I've never had a juvenile shackled to bring into court. The judges don't allow it. In fact, even to have an adult in court shackled, it's specific reasons, and it's even tougher reason to bring a juvenile in court than shackled. I guess I'm just wondering that I think it looks like it's the normal guidelines that the judges use now to provide for shackling in the courtrooms that you're just going to put in the statute. But the other question I have is on this Section 2, developed by the commissioner. I'm just wondering which commissioner it's going to be for this risk assessment, whether it's the Department of Corrections or the Department of Health and Human Services, because this particular set of statutes is written for Health and Human Services, not the Department of Corrections.
Chair, I'm going to have for the Ms. Davis answer the first part of the question, and then Deputy Commissioner will answer the second question.
Very well. Ms. Davis.
Chair Mariani and Representative Johnson, thank you for the question. You know, I would suspect that I don't know where you have been in court, and my experience in Hennepin County is that children also are not shackled. But if you go to other counties in the state, it does happen. It happens every single day, and it happens for status offenses. And so this would be an opportunity to say that what you're speaking about, the experience that you have where it's not happening, is the general experience unless it's absolutely necessary. I will just point out, we did a couple of years ago did a survey of judges from all 10 judicial districts, and 75% of the respondents from all those 10 judicial districts were in favor of banning indiscriminate shackling, and more specifically would favor the limitation in their own jurisdiction. This is happening, and this is really a necessary protection to end the practice of justice by geography. Thank you.
Deputy Commissioner.
Chair Mariani. Chair Representative Johnson. I was going to say Chair Johnson. Thank you for the question. It's my understanding that when you say developed by the commissioner, that will be the commissioner at the Department of Corrections. If you all might remember last year, in my previous capacity, myself and my colleague, this bill was introduced, and there was a fiscal note attached to it. At that point in time, we were not a part of the Department of Corrections, so they would have had to actually farm out that expertise and consult with someone about the development of a risk assessment tool. Now, since we are in-house at the Department of Corrections, that expertise for them has been brought in-house, and I don't say that as a note to myself, probably more so to my colleague. And so now that we are more in-house, there is no fiscal note. And I should also be noted that this isn't something that has to be reinvented. There's a number of our detention facilities and counties around the state right now that are using validated risk assessment tools that they developed and implemented in collaboration with a number of their juvenile justice partners there, along with community members as well. We are not asking for, say, in like Wisconsin, where they have a DRE, which is just one, just for the state. In our opinion, these things should be developed amongst the stakeholders in consultation under the advisement of the Department of Corrections and that commissioner, which is Commissioner Schnell at this current time, in my capacity as well as Deputy Commissioner of our Community Services Division.
So, Deputy Commissioner, for the record, you've established the intent just now relative to the question before us and that Representative Johnson raised. But Representative Johnson.
Mr. Chair, I think at some point, even though we've established on the record here the what I'm hearing, sometimes the courts don't always follow that. I think we're going to have to get this amended at some point to clarify which commissioner is supposed to do it. But I'm also concerned about different, the commissioner could develop one, a county could, a group of counties, a judicial district. I think we need to have one statewide, so be consistent statewide. I think maybe we need to narrow it down to that point. And also the other question, Mr. Chair Mariani, where is this bill headed to next?
The motion is to be referred to the general ledger.
Since this is in the Health and Human Services section, I do believe it needs to go to Health and Human Services, because this is their chapters.
Let me think about that, but we'll continue the conversation. Representative Pinto.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. It's, so Chapter 260B is delinquency, juvenile delinquency. So I guess I'm not so sure. I understand Representative Johnson's point, but I guess I don't see, as I'm looking through the chapter, it's not necessarily that it'd be a DHS thing. I guess it does make sense to me that that we may want to add in the reference of Commissioner of Corrections. It sounds like it'd be the intent. So I'm not so sure that would be clear, but I have to say I would disagree that there's any particular HHS connection with juvenile delinquency.
I'm sorry. Let me ask our committee counsel for thoughts and advice.
Mr. Chair and representatives, Chapter 260B, as Representative Pinto indicated, relates to delinquency. The term commissioner is not actually defined within that chapter. Throughout the chapter, there are many references to both court procedures and to the custody of the commissioner of corrections. In that situation, it does use commissioner of corrections. I would not say that this necessarily falls directly under the jurisdiction of HHS. It's not an HHS or Department of Health chapter, but it's also not specifically stated that it's a Department of Corrections chapter. If the intent is to make this developed by the Department of Corrections, best practice would be to specifically say that.
Chair Mariani, I would be fine with adding clarification, and I think Representative Johnson, I thank you for the clarification on that.
And Chair Mariani, Representative Johnson, to your point about why we don't have one, primarily that is because we understand that across all 87 counties here in Minnesota, we want to honor their individuality and that they know their kids best. They know the issues that are important to them there. They also understand, particularly for those detention facilities that has the discretion on who they allow into their facilities, we want them to be a part of the process. We also want local law enforcement, who are normally the first point of contact, to be a part of this conversation as well. So rather than us going the route that Wisconsin did and mandating counties without giving them a voice or their juvenile justice practitioners and community members to have a voice in this process, our goal, which has been successful around the state and all of the counties that we've implemented, again, not just here in the metro, St. Louis County uses a risk assessment instrument as well. We think it's important for those individual counties, along with their individual county level juvenile justice practitioners, to be a part of that conversation in the development of their risk assessment tool.
Representative Pinto, I believe, on this point.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just under our rules, you can accept minor oral amendments during hearings at your discretion. And with the permission of the author and of you, I wonder if it makes sense simply to just finish this point that on line 2.20 to insert the phrase of corrections after commissioner. So simply say developed by the commissioner of corrections and then just get that over with. Mm-hmm. Obviously up to the author and up to you, Mr. Chair, as to whether that's acceptable.
Seems like an efficient and wise way to proceed. I would ask my colleagues on the other side of the aisle if they would be amenable to doing that at this point.
Sure.
Very well. Okay. So we have a
motion. I will make that motion, Mr. Chair.
All right. We're going to need counsel to state the motion.
Mr. Chair and members, just for the record, the amendment would be page 2, line 20, after commissioner, insert of corrections.
Very well. Is everyone clear? All in favor of that motion, please say aye.
Aye.
All same sign. Motion prevails. That's why let me make sure I have it right. 3.53 is so amended. With that, Representative Poston.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Edelson, you've got a bill that's going to move forward and should move forward, but I'm a little bit concerned about the last line on the bill. It says that this will go into effect on August 15th, 2021. Is that accurate, or is that?
You can go
ahead. Yes, Chair, that's accurate, Representative Poston.
Just curious, why is it pushed out into 2021?
That's a good question. Deputy Commissioner.
Chair Mariani, Representative Post. Primarily because we want to give those stakeholders the opportunity to take time to, A, identify those members who they want to be a part of the process, and to give them time to work through it. Part of when you're trying to establish a tool is you first have to define what is the purpose of secure detention. And I would gather that if I went around even these tables right here and I asked all of you to a representative man and a woman to say, what is the purpose of secure detention for youth? I might get 20 different answers. So the reason why we give that time there where the implementation doesn't take place until August of 2021 is to give those stakeholders, whether they're county stakeholders or community stakeholders, an opportunity to work through that process.
Chair, and Representative Poston, I do a lot of work in education as well, and I'll tell you that when we put these deadlines in, our districts meet them well before the time frame. I imagine that we will probably see results sooner than that.
Makes sense. Thank you very much. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Any further questions? Is there anyone else in the audience that wishes to testify for or against the bill?
Do you have someone forward? Do you want to wait? Chair Mariani, just to the committee and to the members here as well, one last point, particularly around the Ray. As you all probably know, we don't have a central repository for data. In regard to the risk assessment instrument, I think it's important to know that here in Minnesota, we don't have a central repository for data when it comes to our youth. At any given time, I can tell you right now how many men and women that are in our adult facilities right now. I cannot tell you right now how many of our young men, our young boys and girls are currently right now incarcerated in secure detention around the state. One of the primary reasons for that is because we don't have a central repository for data. One thing that a valid risk assessment instrument has done within those counties that we utilize, it also is a tool in a way in which we can collect data. And it gives consistency and uniformity around the ways in which and the measurables that we use and the identifiables that we are able to do to be able to use that data to actually glean some type of information around who are our youth who are being incarcerated into these particular areas. So I think it's incumbent on us, again, for our most vulnerable people who are our young boys and girls to have that information so that we actually know where our youth at any given time across all 87 counties here in Minnesota. Thank you, Chair.
Thank you. Welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the
record. Vanessa Lopez. Good afternoon. September 26, 2017, I found out that I was 6 months pregnant. I was using methamphetamine before that. I had walked into Regents Hospital and reported that my situation. That's when I found out I was 6 months pregnant. At that time, I started working with Mothers First and doing everything that I was supposed to be doing before CPS came involved in my life. September 26th, and then I found out December 11th, I went into labor. I ended up giving birth to a baby boy at 10:10 the next morning. I have a picture of my son being physically restrained by all four limbs from Regents Hospital. Recently, my son is being forced to be adopted out after complying with child protection. I did everything in my possible will to do what I had to do to get my son back because that was the right thing to do. That was my child. I made a mistake, and me and my child are being punished for it. I could say so much more. I investigated my own case and everything. It ties in with the DHS. I know that when they kicked me out the hospital room, that the police report said that it was a delinquent, a juvenile delinquent report from my son from the hospital. They stated that they put him on a 72-hour hold, and there was no 72-hour hold. I feel like they abducted my son, from one hospital to the next because they never got my consent to move him to Children's Hospital. He was medically ready to be discharged 48 hours after. They continued to keep him from me until 1/8/18. I feel like he was kidnapped into child protection adoption system. I did everything on my CPS plan before I even had a CPS plan. They never gave me a chance to neglect my son, to abuse my son. I didn't know I was going to come speak today, but I felt like this was the perfect opportunity to be heard. DHS is, for the last 2 years, I did what I had to do, and, you know, nothing that I complied with was acceptable to my CPS worker, nothing. In and out of treatment, nothing. Anything, nothing. Nothing matters. I went as far as to go into the Father's Project, and I got my parents' certificate there. Father's Project is, if a lot of people don't know, it's for males that are coming out of incarceration and, you know, trying to get back in their children's life. Nobody was directing me to do anything, but I was there and I got my parents' certificate. I did everything in my possible will. February 22nd of 19, they put a petition to terminate my rights. I denied it, went to trial. There's a lot of just misconstruing that whole case. September 24th, 2 years to the date, in 2 days that I found out I was pregnant, September 26, 2017, they terminated my parent rights.
So sorry.
I have a 21-year-old daughter. I've been a single parent. It just ties in with the physical restraint.
Of course. Yeah. Thank you. It takes incredible courage to come forward in public and to share very painful and personal trauma, and this bill does in fact address the need for humanity and the need for us to pay attention to not humiliating and traumatizing other human beings. And so I really appreciate your courage and your sharing of your story with us today. Can you give me again just your last name?
L-O-P-E-Z, Lopez.
Okay, very well. Thank you for being with us here too.
Thank you for listening.
Thank you so much. Representative Johnson. All right. Any other further questions? If not, Representative Edelson, final thoughts, comments?
I just thank you, Chair. I just want to thank the committee for hearing all of the juvenile bills that we have. They're really tough bills, and I thank Ms. Lopez for sharing her story. I think it's really important that we look at streamlining things so that we do have equity across the state in terms of how we approach restraints. We've made such great progress on the RAISE, or risk assessments, and so I just really hope that we can have a bipartisan support on this bill.
Very well. Members, with that, Representative Edelson renews her motion that House File 3453, as amended, be re-referred to the General Register. All in favor of that motion, please say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, same sign. Motion prevails. Deputy Commissioner and Ms. Davis, thank you so much for being with us today. And to our minority leader, thank you, Representative Johnson, for helping to technically make this bill clearer and better. Representative Edelson, you're welcome to change seats. You have two others to choose from. But,
the seat is warm.
Very well. Representative Edelson moves House File 3109. And the motion is to re-refer to Ways and Means. And members of this bill, we will be laying over. Representative Ellison.
Mr. Chair.
Yes, Representative Lucero.
Just a point of clarification. Did you just say it was being moved to Ways and Means, or is it being laid over?
The motion before us is to refer to Ways and Means, but the intent here will be to lay it over.
Okay, so then, Mr. Chair, just a question. I was off the House floor for a period of time. I know at the end there was a series of motions to re-refer from one committee to another. Was this one of the motions, or is this bill currently in our jurisdiction, or is this still in corrections?
There was a motion on the floor to move a bill. Let's have Representative Edelson.
Chair, Representative Lucero, that was the previous bill we just heard, the restraint bill. That was in corrections that we had a motion to re-refer to public safety. This bill is actually in public safety now, the one that we're currently, 3109.
Okay, just want to make sure that it is.
And actually, Representative Edelson, both bills were correctly in this committee, but one did come through as a action on the floor. Representative Lucero. Oh, okay, very well. So I'm being informed, Representative Lucero, maybe this is what you're driving at, I think, that this bill is in corrections, and so we're, yeah. I just looked at it. But it's quite all right. We're not going to be acting on this bill, so let's have an informational hearing.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. That's what I was looking for clarification. Thank you.
I greatly appreciate it. Thank you. Representative Edelson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Representative Lucero. I clearly did not know that. I thought we were. Okay. So, well, good. So House Bill 3109 requires the Department of Corrections to maintain statistical information on the extended jurisdiction juvenile designation on probation. Currently, we have students or youth that are on, have this designation within the prosecutor's office is allowed to do this across the state of Minnesota. And we're really looking, we have some pretty serious reports that a majority of all the youth that are on have this designation are students of color. And right now we do not have statistical data. I think it would be really helpful for the state of Minnesota. I think it'd be helpful for prosecutors' offices to be able to see, one, if that's true, how many students are actually on this designation, the demographics, the population, the length of time. My understanding is there's never early release. And how many successfully are able to graduate this time period, graduate probation. So I have with me today a testifier that works in the area and would like to give him some time to testify and explain a little bit more about why this would be helpful. I also just want to note that, Chair, does everybody have a copy of the county attorney letter in support of this? Thank you. I see there's copies.
It's in the packet.
Beautiful. Thank you. All right. So I'm going to go ahead and turn it over to my first testifier, Dr. Ray Moss.
Dr. Ray Moss, JDI coordinator, Ramsey County. I met Representative Edelson a little bit sometime last year, and I bring this to her attention because the fact is, between Dakota, Hennepin, and Ramsey, EJJ has anecdotally over a 60% fail rate. So that means once the kid gets EJJ, he's 60% likely to fail. A vast majority of the kids on EJJ are black kids. So with that, I reference to Minnesota Statute 2260B, 0.002, Policy on Disproportionate Minority Contact, states it's the policy of the state of Minnesota to identify and eliminate the barriers to racial, ethnic, and fairness within the criminal justice, juvenile justice, correction, and judicial system in support of the fundamental principle of fair and equitable treatment under law. This section alone kind of supports this bill to take a deep dive statewide into the data regarding EJJ because the outcomes are just not good for black kids.
Representative Edelson.
Thank you, Chair Mariani. And, you know, actually, Dr. Moss is my one testifier because the other person could not make it. Let's see here if I want to tell you anything else on this. Yes, and I looked into to see if the Department of Corrections has information, but it does not look like they do. So I think that it's really important. I think the county attorneys think it would be very helpful to look in and see what the numbers say and if there's any early interventions that we can be doing before kids are getting to this, you know, to this point where they're getting this designation, and they may be for serious crimes. Not always violence against a person, some are property crimes, but what this report would do would help us go earlier and see if we can do some interventions before that juvenile enters the system. So I'll stand for questions now. Yeah,
thank you, that's very helpful. That was gonna be my question. So what are we gonna do with the data? And obviously, Dr. Moss, your firsthand knowledge and experience with this demographic group is that there's it sounds like a very large concentration of a racial ethnic group within it. And so I think that begs all sorts of questions, at least for this chair, you know, in terms of what is the state's presence via, you know, our locals. In terms of impacting this particular community. And what are we doing then, therefore, to maximize our ability to, just to run with my theme today, to have a human-centered approach to interacting with them as opposed to just sort of blindly moving them through a system. At least that's what I'm hearing. And so please feel free to expound on why this is important.
No problem. That's a great question. I believe it's important because we got to figure out exit ramps for kids to get off BJJ early. And with this data, we can get together as a collective and try to create something new. Because EJJ was created during the super predator stage of juvenile justice, and I think we move far from beyond that. So it's time to look at it and transform it. And, you know, I think this data can help, you know, create that transformation. Because for EJJ, the number of kids I spoke to in Ramsey County is hopeless. Because once they get EJJ, they know they're on there until they're 21. And that requires heavy surveillance, have to see a probation officer once a week. And that's why, I mean, the fail rate is so high. And that's kind of, it's fair to say that for Dakota and Hennepin. Outside the metro, I can't speak for it. That's why the data helped us understand what's going on outside the metro.
Thank you, Representative Edelson.
Well, Chair, and I to speak off of Dr. Moss's points, I think that we all respond well to if we can perform and do the things that are required of us as juveniles, they'll work harder. People respond well to expectations, and we really have to be able to pull back and see how this program's working. It's a result of a 1994 working group when, to your point, when crime was up. We know that that's not necessarily true now, but looking at youth, how can we, the reason I think it would be helpful and for prosecutors would be helpful is what's happening with all of this, but how can we do early intervention as well as exit ramps?
Very well. Any questions from the committee? We won't be acting on this bill, obviously, but we have a few minutes for discussion. Representative Johnson.
Chair Mariani, I just want to give a shout-out to the Legislative Budget Office. This bill was introduced on the February 11th, and on the 18th, we had a fiscal note.
Terrific. Anyone else wish to, anyone in the audience who wishes to testify? Ms. Garrett Johnson. Welcome back.
So I'm back again, Linda Garrett Johnson. The reason why I wanted to speak this time was because I was a part of the original task force that looked at extended jurisdiction juvenile in Minnesota and created the body of legislation that it now exists. And it's been a long time. It's been at least 20, 25 years, I think, since that legislation passed. And the interesting thing about it is that when I look at this, what we're trying to do here is that I'm just aghast that we don't have statistics about the young people that were that have been categorized as EJJ, that for the past 20, 25 years since that piece of legislation was passed, we have really no statistics about them. In my other life, my regular life, I am a data person. I am a Six Sigma process improvement consultant. I help organizations look at and research and put statistical measures in place to understand how well they're doing. And I would just encourage us to do something to make sure that we understand, that we correct the fact that we have no data, no statistic. We have young people or, you know, with this classification, but we have no way of understanding what's happening with them, how many people are there, where are they. I know when I was a part of that task force, the one thing that I was really concerned about was housing young people in adult facilities. So I'd like to know how many young people have been housed in adult facilities, what happened to them, was it a good thing, was it a bad thing? You know, there's so many things that we need to look at. So that's why I wanted to, I implore you to please pass something like this so we can actually understand what's going on with this body of legislation.
Thank you, Ms. Garrett Johnson. It sounds like this bill is long overdue. And my hope is that when it does move, when it is before a committee for action, that we move it. Representative Elson, we need to get out of here for another committee. So last quick words.
Just one more. 110 have been certified as adults of youth. So I just wanted to make sure she got that. No less words. I just encourage bipartisan support on this bill. It's a good bill.
Very well. Thank you. And thank you, Dr. Moss, for being with us today. Members, this bill is not formally before us, so there will be no action on it at this point. And until tomorrow, this committee stands adjourned. No.